changes coming from Olympia. Victims of sexual assault have more time now to report the crime under a bill just passed by the legislature, and it looks like a bill to strengthen hate crime laws is moving ahead. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
It's an effort that has been pushed by sexual assault survivors and their advocates for years. And yesterday, a bill to eliminate the statute of limitations for most child sex crimes and extend them to 20 years for adults finally crossed the finish line in the legislature. This was the Senate version of a bill Representative Dan Griffey, whose wife and daughter are both sexual assault survivors, has proposed for 5 years.
Why do we need to pass this bill? A lot of people ask me all the time, why? They deserve it. No other survivor group does this body allow to be maligned as much as sexual assault survivors. We need a right or wrong with this policy in Washington State. It's time.
Representative Michelle Caldier shared her own story of sexual abuse by her stepfather to stress just how important the change was, explaining it can take years for an abused child to come forward, as was the case with her younger sister.
And I took her aside and I asked her if he'd done anything to her. And what she said is so awful, I cannot repeat it. And see, when I came out and I started telling people, it was embarrassing. I had to tell so many law enforcement, so many teachers, so many social workers, and a lot of people didn't believe me. And you know what they said? If this was happening, why aren't your sister saying anything?
The bill also ends the requirement for prosecutors to prove a victim actively said no or fought back hard enough to prove rape in the third degree, a standard unlike any other that can be extremely hard to prove because this crime usually involves date rape or a victim incapacitated by alcohol. Mary Ellen Stone with the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center calling passage of the bill a major victory.
I mean, this is the biggest thing that's happened for victims of sexual assault easily in the last 20 years. It's historic.
The bill is now headed to the governor, who is likely to sign it. Another bill one step closer to the governor's desk after passing the Senate yesterday strengthens Washington's hate crime laws. Under current state law, crimes motivated by hate are called malicious harassment. This bill would redefine that to call them hate crime offenses. Supporters say with hate crimes on the rise across the country and in our state, this is an important step to changing our culture. Democratic Senator Jesse Solomon says it's a culture that is going to force him to have a dreaded conversation with his young son about why there are armed guards at their synagogue.
And I don't know how I'm going to answer that. We know that there are some people in this country that will kill us at our place of worship, and that they will kill children, and that they have... And that we have to defend ourselves. And it's going to be the first time where it dawns on him that we live in a world like this.
Democrat Mona Dawes says it will help protect people from becoming targets of hate the way she was as a member of the Sikh community the day after 9/11.
And when I came back to my hotel room, there was a piece of ham covered in ketchup. And it was thrown at my door. And I will never forget that moment. As long as I live, and how scared I was to go into my hotel room because I did not know what would be waiting for me on the other side.
But Republican Senator Mike Padden worries renaming it to a hate crime could have unintended consequences.
Prosecutors have told me over and over again, it's far more difficult to get a conviction if it's a hate crime than if it's malicious harassment, because people and jurors are going to infer that they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a high standard in a criminal case, the intent.
Hannah joins us live now. Hannah, is there, I mean, this testimony is absolutely terrifying from these victims, but is there evidence that extending the window for reporting sexual assault and changing the name of the hate crime law, does that act as a deterrent? Does it stop people from doing any of this stuff in the first place?
Well, as far as the statute of limitations bills go, this is much more geared towards giving the victims a voice, making a change for sexual assault survivors to feel that they can come forward. A big part of this is that they've learned that, especially when we're talking about child victims, there's such trauma and it can take such a long time for them to feel comfortable coming forward. They really want to make sure that when they get to that point, no matter how many years it is down the road, that they will feel like there's a welcoming environment for that, that they will get the support and be believed. I do want to point out that this is not a retroactive bill. So this would only apply going forward. So there is, though, a little bit of that hope that maybe, you know, several years down the line, as we start to see these cases, when they moving forward in prosecution, that perhaps this does work as a deterrent so that, you know, those who attack people are knowing that they could face this for the rest of their life.
That's got to be the message, to know that no matter how many years might pass, you will be held responsible for this. Even if you think people will forget, they won't.
Yeah, absolutely. And that'll remain to be seen as we move forward again in the future. But this was a huge, huge victory for sexual assault survivors and bipartisan. This post passed 94-1 yesterday.
Hannah Scott, Olympia. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. A 7-Eleven convenience store owner in Toledo, Ohio, is getting praise from the community for handling a shoplifter the way he did. Jintendra, or Jay Singh, says he was watching on his surveillance system as the teen stole food. Then he confronted him and was surprised by the boy's response.
He said, "I'm stealing it for myself. I'm hungry. And I'm doing it for my younger brother."
Rather than calling police, Jay told WTVG-TV he sent the teen on a shopping spree. Gave him pizza, sandwiches, other food and drinks, all free of charge.
"It's not going to make any difference to me if I give him some food, because we make a lot of food, we sell a lot of food. If he goes to jail, then he's definitely not going to do anything good in life."
Customers saw it happen, posted about it on Facebook. It's gotten a lot of attention. Jay's wife isn't surprised by his generosity, though.
"And I'm really proud of him, and it is the true self of himself. I know him. He's very kind. We are part of the community, and we have to help the community, so that is a part of our job."
Jay says he only hopes the teen maybe pays it forward when he can, or they're exploring if they can actually offer that teen a job.
Sounds like a good idea. Sounds like he could use one. It's time now for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here's what happened last night in Kansas City.
Swinging a fly ball to right field and deep. In toward the corner. Going back, Merrifield. Goodbye, baseball. With one swing of the bat, the Mariners have tied a Major League record. It is the 14th consecutive game in which the Mariners have hit a home run. That ties the 2002 Cleveland Indians.
They play again this morning. First pitch at 10:15. Here's Danny O'Neill. The big test is coming, right?
Okay, going to have Houston coming in here beginning tomorrow. That's right. Let's bring him in here. Two-time reigning division champs. Let's go.
Yeah.
See what they got.
They ready?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah, they've won 12 of their first 14 games. Yeah. It's not going to be better. They're not going to be better prepared than this.
What's shiny about Houston?
Houston has the best, and last season definitely had the best pitching staff.
Still
one
do?
Through five starting staff. The back end of their rotation has been a little rough to start this season. But yes, I still think that they do. Dallas Keuchel is a former Cy Young Award winner. He's not with them anymore. So that's taken a bite out of that rotation. But they have the best pitching. And then they absolutely have and are stocked. A lineup that is the breadth of talent that Houston has is one of the reasons that precipitated Seattle deciding, you know what, we're going to gear up for 2 years from now when we think that through attrition and some of the players becoming more expensive, that Houston is going to come back to the pack a little bit. So we'll see. Houston would still be the favorite to win the division.
Is that what Houston did? Did they do a rebuild? Is that why they're good today?
Yes.
Okay.
About 10 years ago, they went through the extreme rebuild where for about 2 years, they were deliberately awful at the major league level. They sold everything that could move, could fetch anything at the major league level. And they were historically bad. And they used draft picks and they used all of the prospects that they acquired in that to essentially stock their system with these players that have now progressed to the major league level.
They were always my favorite card to collect as a child.
Really?
They were so retro.
I thought they looked like the human popsicles.
That's why I liked them, I think. They were so colorful.
Their color scheme? Yeah. Let's go.
Mustard, ketchup, and what else is in there?
All right. So, Houston, that's the game this morning, right?
No, they're playing Kansas City. They wrap up that series, and then they host Houston beginning
tomorrow.
T-Mobile Park.
All right. Let's, I'm looking at my watch, and it's April 11th. The Russell Wilson deadline is the 15th. Has anything happened?
Well, we're going to see. No, all signs point to currently that there's no deal, but a contract negotiation is a lot like pregnancy. You either are.
Tell me how.
You either are or you aren't.
Okay.
There's no, we're close to a deal. You don't get almost pregnant, right?
Yeah, I suppose in vitro would be the closest since you do.
You do plan that, but even then it's a positive or a negative. It's like a light switch, right?
Well, it's positive in the dish before it's positive in you.
Okay, that fair enough, fair enough. So the conception just takes place in a different setting.
Yeah. Maybe
different
the doctor in vitro
torture
is the
analogy
agent.
I've ever heard on the air.
I'm going to be accurate.
The thing I want to bring up, though, is that Matt Ryan, the Atlanta quarterback, just got this huge deal, right?
Yeah.
And Russell, and he hadn't even won anything, has he?
No.
So how much did he get?
Well, he got $93 million guaranteed.
Over
a five-year contract. But he's going to, the total contract, NFL contracts, there's two numbers to be concerned about.
Right.
One is the total value, and that's so five-year, $150 million contract. Okay. And then the amount that's guaranteed, because in the NFL, most players don't play through the end of their contract.
Right.
So the amount that's guaranteed is the amount that you should
earn. He's got to get at least, so then Russ is going to want at least $93 million,
yes.
Right?
Yes, and the Seahawks will give that to him.
They will.
The Seahawks are offering that to him. So the question is, how much more? Should it be $35 million per year as opposed to $30 million? Should it be $98 million guaranteed as opposed to $93? How do you guarantee it? Like, what are the mechanisms that you use to quote-unquote guarantee it? There's a lot of things to argue about if they want to. And apparently, that's the interest. Neither side is willing to hedge on at least one issue so far because there's no deal yet. Hmm. And we'll see.
Help me understand Earl Thomas saying he wants to retire as a Seahawk. I have no idea what to make of that.
Well, he doesn't want to burn any bridges. Did you hear him say that?
Well, I guess his little birdie burned that bridge a long time ago.
There's that. There was also him holding out for training camp. There's him posting on Instagram. The disrespect has been well noted and will not be forgotten.
Is he just trolling us?
No.
Are you serious?
That is as earnest as Earl can possibly be. He doesn't think anything that's happened has burned a bridge. And you know what? I think he's probably right.
Okay.
I think he probably will be able to retire as a Seahawk. He'll be remembered as a Seahawk. It's where his best years will have been. I thought it was a great sign. It was just hilariously Earl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, you remember that time that I went into another team's locker room and said, if y'all want me, come get me? Oh, that wasn't burning a bridge. Yeah. He's kind of blissfully unaware of the significance.
But he says he sees himself maybe signing a one-day deal, and then they will hang his jersey in the rafters.
Yeah. That's the Ring of Honor. That would be the, and players do that. They generally will come back to the team that they were, sign a one-day contract and retire as a Seahawk in that way. He won't ever play for the Seahawks again.
Okay, so that's what that means. So he's not actually coming
ceremonial.
Back to play. This is ceremonial.
But he will be remembered as a Seahawk, and hell, he's going to be a Hall of Famer probably. You want him to go in as a Seahawk, right?
Sure.
Not a Raven. That's not his aviary allegiance.
What even is that?
Yeah. I don't want to burn a bridge. If somebody flipped you off, Dave, would that be burning a bridge in your book?
I'm not worth flipping off.
Well,
thank you, Danny.
That needs to be discussed.
I disagree.
I'm so tempted, but Dave's so nice.
I know.
If it was anybody else, I would have double-barreled birds flying right now.
I feel bad swearing in front of him.
I know. It's
just
tough.
So innocent.
He's so nice.
We're out of time for the segment. What can I say?
He's blushing, I think.
Thank you, Danny.
Bye.
Bye. This morning, Sports Insight is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Choke points.
Let's go.
Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. We are more than 3.5 years into the 405 tolling. Drivers generally love it, but they still have a few.
Really?
Well,
some of them love it.
Based on the number of people that I see using those lanes. But they still have a few questions that seem to revolve around fairness.
Yeah, so this is one that just is kind of a reminder of how the system was set up. A lot of the drivers feel right now the system isn't fair because they end up paying for miles in the toll lanes that they are not actually driving. So, for example, when you leave Bellevue, the toll sign there going northbound lists three destinations and three prices. When you exit at that location, you pay the price for how far you have driven in the toll lanes. The exits are Totem Lake, Highway 522, and Linwood at I-5. Now, the drivers that reached out to me wonder why there isn't, say, a toll exit and a price for getting off at Canyon Park. For instance, and for those that don't know, that's between the 522 toll and the I-5 toll. because basically, if you're getting off at Canyon Park, you're paying for going 3.5 more miles in the toll lane than you actually did. And so, like, why am I have to pay for a toll when I'm not actually using the road? So I went to Chris Foster at the tolling division for an explanation. And there are several parts of this reasoning for this. And the first comes down to the Federal Highway Administration's guidelines for toll signage.
The Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices, it's a manual from the FHWA, limits us to displaying a maximum of 3 destinations on a toll rate sign.
So you can only have 3. They think to add more would be more distracting.
If we had 6 different destinations on the sign, that would be really hard to read in a, you know, as you're driving by.
So what about maybe changing the destinations so you still only have 3 destinations, but say changing them? Say, for instance, once you pass Totem Lake, one of those destinations could be, by the way, if you're continuing up to Canyon Park, this is what it would be. Well, the state also thinks that would be confusing, and their data says that the 3-zone system works.
We chose those by analyzing trip data, including, you know, the origin and destination of these trips, and just working to model those movements.
And so they said their data suggests that more people are going all the way to I-5 than they are getting off at Canyon Park. Now, the distances are even more severe in the southbound direction. I normally get on at Canyon Park when I'm driving, and so to kind of see what it is. But I went up yesterday again and drove all the way from the Linwood beginning and got into the toll lanes right there at the start, right, and kind of figured out what happens. The first toll zone that you have going southbound goes from Linwood all the way to Totem Lake, 8 miles. Now, if you get off at Canyon Park, you're paying for 6 miles of the express toll lane that you did not drive. If you get off at 522, you're paying for about 3 miles that you aren't driving. So I can understand people's kind of frustration in that, well, geez, I'm paying, but I'm not actually going the distance. But the state defends it and says that's the way it was set up, and we believe it's working that way. But yeah, people are paying for miles that they are not actually driving.
Well, I mean, if you ride the bus, you pay as much for a 3-block ride downtown as you do to come in from Bellevue.
That is true. I mean, these are just kind of the hidden costs or just the ways of doing business for a system like this to work. Because you can't have an exit for every single location, or especially when it's congestion pricing like this where it's so variable. I think we would run into we'd go down a very deep rabbit hole trying to make everybody happy. But yeah, I think the point is taken, that they're paying for miles that they aren't actually driving.
Okay, we have a magic message on this subject. Mike writes, "Hi, Chris. I normally drive down to Redmond from the North End early in the morning most days of the week to avoid the majority of the traffic and the higher toll rates. Normally, the tolls are at the minimum unless there's an accident. But for the past couple of weeks, the minimum toll I've seen in the morning has been $3 and up to $6.75. Can you check with the DOT and see if they've changed the algorithm on the tolling, or is this the new norm?"
Well, I checked, and it's the new norm. The algorithm has been recently changed, according to the Department of Transportation. So you are seeing much higher tolls much earlier, and when potentially to your view, to the driver's view, they aren't warranted because the congestion isn't there. But the state tells me they have created more of a proactive algorithm right now and less reactive. So it's anticipating when the congestion will begin in a help to price people out of the lane to prevent the congestion from being worse as it gets going. So I'm not sure if I explained that well enough.
No, we're going to keep the riffraff route earlier
and,
so
and anticipate based on travel data that we have when the congestion usually starts. So yes, that's the new norm. I got a text this morning too, someone saying it's been 75 cents for all 3 years that I've been driving this thing. You know, the last couple of weeks have been 4.25. And yes, they've changed their algorithm in order to anticipate the traffic. And if it doesn't show up, well, they bring it down. But yes, the algorithm has changed. Mike was dead on that.
All right. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We are surrounded by pregnancy in the newsroom lately. I'm flanked on both sides.
Baby boom, right? I'm the first. I'm due May 8th, and then our morning editor, Alicia, due May 30th, and then Michael Medved's assistant, Carmen, she's due in July.
Right, right.
Everywhere.
Everybody's congratulating you and Alicia, and it's supposed to be great, and yet sometimes, well, you know this because you already have a child, the reality is different. That's what Polly Rosenwake is writing about. She's going to be at Elliott Bay Books tonight up on Capitol Hill. The name of your book is Look How Happy I'm Making You. Is that ironic?
It is. It is ironic. It actually meant to tap into the fact that our children, of course, do make us happy, but at the same time, sometimes they can be frustrating.
Why do you think that the negative aspects of parenting or the complaints you might have or the struggles you might have, why do you think those are actively suppressed in our society?
I think we want to think of mothers as sort of self-sacrificing, all-caring beings. And especially when a baby is born, it is a wonderful kind of blissful event in some ways. But I think we don't quite want to address that it's also really challenging.
But why? Where does that come from? This idea that we cannot say that it's hard or that we might have momentarily regretted it, that you know, if you say it's hard and I'm struggling, that means you don't like your child, you know, that it has to have an equal and opposite reaction instead of it being I'm happy sometimes and I'm unhappy also sometimes.
I mean, I think it comes from sort of the glossy magazine cover images of women that make it seem as if, you know, having a baby is purely a magical experience. And I think that there's just so much care involved in taking care of a new baby that you feel like you have to be fully invested. Mm-hmm. But I think it's changing as well. And I think more and more people are talking about the difficulties.
And where did that, is it the younger generations of moms who are saying, enough, mm-hmm. this is hard, I'm going to complain about it? Because I follow on Instagram, there's an account called Scary Mommy. And it's truth telling about motherhood, and it's so refreshing to see it, because the moment you feel like you're failing, you read something you can relate to on Scary Mommy and go, oh, I'm not so alone.
Yeah. I think blogs and people telling their stories in different ways, telling their honest stories, has helped to change that.
Yeah. My daughter just had her first, and I'm the one she talks to about it.
Oh, that's nice.
Most of the time. And she is discovering what my wife discovered and what I, although to a lesser extent, discovered, is that it's your job. It becomes your full-time job.
Right.
And the difference is my generation, my wife basically gave up her job to do the baby thing. And my daughter does not want to do that. Mm-hmm. And is very worried about what the effect will be on her career, because she sees what happens when you take a long break for pregnancy. I think that's probably some of the source of this pressure, isn't it?
And the answer you get from a lot of people when you say, oh, I can't afford it, child care is so expensive, then don't have children. I mean, that's usually the response you get. And it's, that's not fair. You should be able to have the children you want and also work at the same time and afford the child care. It's not the parent that's the issue. It's the child care system.
Absolutely.
No, I'm just getting on a soapbox. Sorry.
But I think that's legitimate, because part of the reason that you get this image is that we cover the child rearing experiences of celebrities who have infinite amounts of money to spend on the child care. So sure, they're happy and blissful because they're not seeing the kid. The nurse probably knows more about the kid than they do. But you clearly felt it was important, though, to tell these stories, right?
Right. And the book is fiction. So it's a collection of stories about different women's experience with pregnancy and having a baby. But it did come out of my own emotional experience, wanting a baby, having some trouble getting there, having a miscarriage, finally having a baby, and then feeling overwhelmed by this new motherhood identity and how I was going to.
And then did you feel guilty? Because, I mean, obviously you wanted a child badly. Yeah. And the disappointment of the miscarriage, then finally having one, then realizing, oh, this kid needs to be fed, needs attention, and all the rest of that.
I did feel guilty, but at the same time, I try to push against the guilt, because my own mother worked full time, and that's something that I really admire about her. I've continued to admire about her. For my daughter, I have two daughters now. I want them to see that my work is also important to me and fulfilling, and that I can find time to take care of them and work.
I just want to know where this pressure is coming from, if it's usually found in your interpersonal relationships, or if it's media, or if it's society at large. Because just this week, I had to push back against my own guilt when our morning nanny, who makes breakfast for my daughter, gets her to the bus stop safe, called in sick. My husband has to get to work. I'm already at work because we have our show so early in the morning. I end up leaning on one of my stay-at-home mom friends. And in my mind, I'm going, if you didn't work, you'd be there for your child. You wouldn't be putting the burden on other people. Your daughter wouldn't feel like, where's my parents? Why aren't they supporting? You know, and I had to go, stop, you know. And of course, my friend's like, yeah, it takes a village. I'm happy to do it for you. But where does that inner dialogue come from? What stories have you heard from women about what do they feel the pressure is coming from?
It's such a complicated question. I think it does come from this idea that women need to sort of juggle it all and that women are often the ones responsible, right? In many families, there is a father too. And I think that it's often seen as the woman's responsibility. Girls often play mommy, right? And boys don't tend to play daddy. And so I think it does start early, this idea that females are the ones that do the caring and the caretaking for children.
So the real guilt will come when your child's playing mommy and mommy tells the doll, sorry, but my job is more important than you, so I'm putting you away for now while I go do my job.
I'm bracing for that conversation with my daughter and her dolls. No, she, you know, she's asked, she went through a phase where she would cry at night saying, I don't, because when she wakes up in the morning, I'm not there. And she went through a phase where I don't want you to work. I wish you didn't work. And I had to explain to her why I do. And that I like my job, but I love you. And then we have a compromise now where I leave her a note every morning so that at least mommy's there somehow. But it is complicated.
I also know that my children have had great caretakers, both nannies and preschool teachers. And these are people trained in early childhood development. You know, I'm not trained.
Well, that's
in
another
early childhood development.
Sword. You get people saying, I don't want somebody else raising. The reason why I stay at home is because I don't want somebody else raising my child, implying that a working parent is just passing off the parenting to somebody else. It's a very complicated web of hurt feelings.
Yeah, and I happen to think that I love the fact that these other wonderful people who are really great with taking care of children have taken care of my children, and I think it actually contributes a lot to my children's lives to have other caring adults besides me and besides their father.
So would you advocate for more pushback when you hear, well, I don't want somebody else raising my child?
Yeah. And of course, stay-at-home motherhood, I mean, that's a choice that a lot of people make. And I think that's a legitimate choice. But I also do think, yes, that we should push back against the idea that mothers need to be the ones caring for their children all of the time.
Look How Happy I'm Making You by Polly Rosenwick. She'll be at Elliott Bay Books tonight at 1521 10th Avenue. Polly, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien, and here's Rachel Bell. This is a story that sounds like it was an old black and white movie once. Things being smuggled into prisons using books for prisoners. And the state corrections officers, at one point last week, actually banned nonprofit groups from sending any more books to the prisons?
Yeah, so there's a nonprofit group in our state called Books to Prisoners, and for decades they have been sending used books into the state prison. So how it works is prisoners can request what they want to read, and then this nonprofit has volunteers. They'll go out and they'll try to find it, and then they'll send them in. But very quietly last month, the prisons banned this decades-long practice. And it was only when the nonprofit realized, like, hey, we're still sending in the books and they're coming back, that they realized that actually there had been, I don't know if you should go so far to say legislation, but within the prisons they had made this
new rule.
Right. And so only then did they bring it to the public, and the public became outraged, like, hey, and of course the prisoners and Governor Jay Inslee, you know, that's not cool. Like, people need something to do in there. These people are going to be back on the streets, most of them.
I think there's,
you know, 97%. Maybe we could give them something to read. And the reason they banned the books was they said that in 17 instances, contraband was reportedly found in the books. Like, the prisoners were using it to transport drugs or tattoo guns amongst each other, or people from the outside were letting drugs in the books. And the problem was not because of the prisoners. The problem was that they just didn't have the monitoring system. When the books would come in, they didn't have the staff to look through them. So that all came out last week. But this week in the Seattle Times, there was an article that said, actually, those 17 separate instances that the DOC is citing, they can't actually prove that any of those were connected to books at all. Not sure why they made this connection. I mean, in one case, they say that one of the cases, an individual was caught with contraband by Officer Booker. So just the fact that the word book, you know, is in his name somehow flared some.
Somebody did a database search linking books and contraband, and that's how these stats were derived.
Yes.
And it turns out you can't do that because computers are stupid.
Yes, because there's another quote that says someone was booked for being found with contraband. So this has not been corrected yet. And, you know, a lot of people are hoping that it will be. Like I said, Governor Jay Inslee is fighting to get this program back. Because like I said, I mean, I've been very passionate about covering stories about people in Washington jails and prisons, because like I said, 97% of them are going to get out.
Right.
And there's just this stigma and this idea of put them in jail, lock them up, throw away the key. They don't deserve anything. Like, you don't deserve a book. You did a crime. You shouldn't get to be entertained. But you don't want somebody coming out who has just been stewing away, who hasn't gotten to use their brain, who hasn't gotten to try to right their wrongs, who hasn't tried to change in any way, coming out, because they're going to be exactly the same as they were going in.
Reading education changes people. I mean, sometimes the reason you go to prison is because you're ignorant. You don't know how the world really works. And the more reading, it seems to me, the better. Plus, I got a lot of books I'd like to donate to some useful purpose.
Without contraband, I hope.
Well, I check all my books for contraband. Hey, but is it the book's fault if somebody takes a donated book and hollows it out and uses it to trade match heads or whatever the current currency is in prisons?
Yeah, it seems like they're not focusing on the right thing here. It's like, oh, books are bad because books can be turned into receptacles. Like, okay.
Anything can be in a prison. I mean, they're very clever. I think one of the things you learn in prison is how to be clever. I just hope you can apply that when you get out. But to ban the books over this seems ridiculous. So now that this case has had the publicity, and now that you've even picked up on it, surely the policy will change.
I'm sure that it will change because of me. The story alone is going to do it. But yeah, so they're going to be working on it. I don't know, you know, what kind of things they went through within the prison rules to make this ban in the first place, of how hard or easy it is to unlock it. But I think because they did it so quietly, now that a lot of people are noticing it and it's in the Seattle Times, I think they might at least get pressured into giving them the books back.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a happy ending to me.
I think so.
Cairo Radio's Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.